Remus dribbles out of traffic. Back to Addie Budke in the corner. Good decision. She doesn't check the three. Now Addie drives baseline. Great pass underneath. Goddard wide open. Layup good for Kylie Goddard on the fantastic feed by Addie Budke. And Beloit's up by five. It didn't hit the rim. So 1 second, Beloit gets the ball. Budke to get it in to Miley Brown. It's loose on the floor, and that's the ball game. And the Beloit Lady Trojans have pulled off the upset over the first-ranked team in the state 3A. Beloit knocks off the Lady Panthers 51-49.
Slavic misses. Rebound. Quick outlet up ahead to Luters. Wide open. Layup is a record breaker there for Trinity into the 1,000-point mark for Osborne. Trinity Luters with 15 in the game, and that's what she needed coming into tonight. She hits that 1,000-point barrier for Osborne as they lead by 8 again, 37-29.
Beiser steps through to Gershner, three-pointer for the lead. Bingo! Gershner with his second three, all 8 of his points in the second half, and Beloit leads 35-33. Oh, a nice spin, kick out. Kayla Burks, three-pointer, good! Kayla Burks saves the best time to hit his first three of the night, and Beloit's up by 6.
Pretty exciting stuff last night over in Osborne, also in Beloit High School basketball. Welcome to Sports Ticket, Wade and Dusty with you. And, you know, I think we'll talk college football bowl game last night, Texas Bowl between K-State and LSU also coming up, Big 12 basketball. And also an idea that might prevent football players from opting out of bowl games that we'll present to you after a long discussion yesterday about understanding why players are opting out of bowl games. Some people agree with that. Some people do not. But we begin with high school basketball, and I'll start with the games I did last night, and I can throw it to you for yours because you have an athlete. We have an athlete in our midst that had a nice milestone in a very quick period of time when you consider how talented she is.
For sure.
And that's a bit of a tease because, you know, the Phillipsburg point guard, Taryn Sides, had 1,000 points basically in her first 2 years, and she's committed to play basketball at K-State, and she and Phillipsburg came to town last night to play Beloit. And the Beloit girls were a heavy underdog in this game. The last time they played Phillipsburg was 10 months ago in the first round of sub-state and lost by 41 and were down 17-0. So there weren't many people giving them a chance to win this game. Some didn't even think they'd probably be competitive in this game. And the Beloit girls, you know, tight game throughout, led a good portion of the game, at one point led by 7. And the Beloit girls have improved so much from last year. They're more athletic than last year. They have a few new faces and different starters, this and that. But they're more athletic. They're more confident. They're just better basketball players. That's the best way to put it. They have really improved their game. They shoot the ball so much better. They don't hesitate. They're not afraid to shoot. They're not afraid to handle the ball. And they still are a relatively young team. I mean, they got freshmen and sophomores playing. So the Beloit girls last night winning, as you just heard the call, 51-49, was a gigantic win for Beloit. The Lady Trojans have won more games this year already than they did all of last year. They were 3-13 this year. They're 4-3. And remember, they gave Southeast all they could handle, a top 10 team in 3A earlier in the year at Southeast. And I think without that game, I don't know if they'd do what they did last night. I think that gave them some confidence as well. And so the Beloit girls win. And after the game, I had a chance to catch up with head coach Shauna Remus. And she says that, you know, we believed, our team believed, her team was ready to go, and talks about how big a win it is for the Beloit girls basketball program.
And our kids weren't afraid. I mean, they weren't afraid of anything. And we hit some really big shots, and we were so patient on the offensive end. And we understood time and possession. And I just couldn't be prouder of them. I mean, we have grown so much. I think it's the biggest win that I've had as a coach to this point anyway, in terms of just getting a team to believe in what I wanted them to do, and then getting them to execute it to almost perfection. And we were in that game from the tip, and the kids believed, and it was huge. I mean, there was just a complete team effort. Everybody that came off the bench did exactly what we asked them to do, and they knew their role, and it was just fun. It was just a fun game to be a part of.
Great win for Beloit, and they're led by coach's daughter, Peyton, had a breakout game, a career-high 21. She hit 5 3-pointers. I only remember her missing one shot the whole night, and that was her last three-point attempt. I mean, everything she shot was swish. And that's kind of how Taryn Sides was, too. She had 24, 5 threes in the second half, and all those, I don't even know if they hit the rim either. It was really fun to watch the shooting exhibition that both Remus and Sides put on. And the Beloit girls last year made 21 threes all year. This year, through seven games, they've made 39.
Yeah.
They made eight more threes last night. Remus made five. Brown made a couple. Addy Budke had a huge three there before halftime. So they're able to shoot at perimeter. And one thing that I think adds a different dimension to the Beloit girls basketball team is Addison Butke's vision as a post player. Because she is really, really good at setting up her teammates with a pass. And last night she had a huge play where she was in the corner and caught it, a post out on the perimeter. And you're like, oh no, what's going to happen here? And she didn't panic at all. She didn't chuck the shot that she could have. And then she goes, oh, I can drive right by this gal. She does. Oh, another gal came on me. What do you know? Instead of forcing a pass, just nice pass to Goddard for an easy layup.
Mm-hmm.
That's basketball IQ. That's absolutely high quality basketball IQ. And the Beloit girls last night, I was kind of waiting for them to have maybe a minute or two where they struggle with Phillipsburg's pressure at the end. You know, when they were down trying to force turnovers, Sides is so quick and so athletic. And it didn't materialize. The Beloit girls did a great job of handling the pressure. They made free throws. Miley Brown down the stretch. Goddard had a huge block shot, had that big bucket I referred to. It was a collective team effort. And then, of course, Miley Brown did a pretty good job on Terrence Sides. You're not going to shut her down. She's awesome. She's a junior already committed to play D1 ball at K-State. That's how good she is. And she put on an exhibition at halftime warming up. I just watched her. And every shot she took, and there was like 24 feet NBA threes, swish. I mean, not hitting the rim. And she had a shot to tie it there with 11 seconds to go. And it was online. It was just a hair short. It was a great move. Pump fake, moved to her left. Brown did everything she could to fight through screens, and she still got a clean look, even though the defense was really good. So it's a great win for Beloit, and it does a lot for this girls' program. It gives a lot of confidence. And you look down the line here, I know it's a ways away, but there isn't. I mean, this Beloit team has a chance to make a push for state. I mean, if you can beat Phillipsburg, and if you can be up early in the fourth quarter on the road at Southeast of Saline, absolutely. There's no, and Southeast is in their sub-state this year. So they're a long way to go, no doubt. But to see the improvement in 10 months, and granted, Phillipsburg did not, they had a couple girls that graduated, and they had another girl that was hurt and out the whole year that played last year, but she got hurt in volleyball. So they're not the exact same team that beat Beloit by 41 10 months ago, but they have maybe the best player in the state in 3A Terrence Sides. And they also have some size, and they got the Gross girl could shoot the ball. And Beloit, they're more athletic, they're more confident, and in 10-month period of time, they went from losing by 41 and being embarrassed because it was just one-sided, experience versus inexperience, to now, 10 months later, winning by two on their home floor against that team. Like I said, the pieces are a little bit different for both teams, but still, it's pretty amazing stuff.
Well, I mean, it's 43-point difference in the games,
right.
You know, and it doesn't matter who is back, who's not, whatever the case may be. That's
well,
an accomplishment.
Well, it does. If Terrence Sides doesn't play, I can explain from 41 to winning.
Yeah, I mean, if you lose, like, everybody. But,
well, I'm talking, like, if you lose a superstar.
Yeah.
I mean, the person that made you go, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I mean, that's going to be different.
Right.
But
when the biggest characters are still involved.
And, you know, as far as the other players or whatever has happened, I mean, the 43-point difference in a game is obviously a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, no matter who's there, what's going on.
Right.
When you can do that and, you know, feel vindicated and understand that, hey, you know, we learned something last time and we learned from a tough season, right?
Mm-hmm.
To put it all together and to come back with, you know, a better mindset and a mindset of, hey, last year was last year. We don't care about it anymore. We're going to make improvements. And I've seen that in the games that I've done. Beloit this year, you know, it's just like you can see the vast improvement and way more confidence from this team.
Confidence
than what you saw last year.
When you play with confidence, you play well.
Yeah,
I mean, it's simple. When you play aggressive and with confidence, you usually play well. You at least have a chance to play well. When you go out timid and you're not aggressive and you lack confidence, and if you're timid, that usually means you lack confidence. If you lack confidence, you're going to struggle in anything you do, whether it's sports or life. And the other thing, too, is you go back to the Southeast game where they lost by, I think it was 7. They're up by 2 early in that fourth quarter. That was a team that beat them by 30 both times, or almost 30 both times back in, you know, February. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 9 months later, 10 months later, They were up two in the fourth. And Southeast girls have all their starters back. They have all their players back. And Beloit, really, the only change is that you've got one person slide in the starting lineup that came off the bench, and another in the freshman Budke. You got a few other kids that come off the bench that, you know, a couple freshmen play here and there a little bit. But, you know, for the most part, it's pretty much the same team for Beloit. And so when I saw that huge improvement just against Southeast, knowing Southeast has all this experience and has everybody coming back, and then to do that, I'm like, okay, that's the eye opener for me. Mm-hmm. That was when my eyes were opened to, like, wow, this team, wow, this is something that really could turn into a really good year. So they've already won more games than they did last year.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty impressive. So Remus with 21, Budke with 11, Brown with 10, and Kylie Goddard adds a couple of huge plays off the bench, a bucket, a block shot. I think she had a big rebound too. It was huge for Beloit. And when Sides got going, and you knew she would, she exploded for 20 in the second half. She had 11 in the third. That's when I think, you know, if that happened to Beloit the last couple of years, I think they would have been, you know, in some trouble. But they just matched it. They handled it. They didn't freak out. They didn't panic, and that's a sign of maturity and more experience. And so Coach Remus is extremely happy and pleased with the win. She should be. And now they'll go to Hoisington on Friday. And then so the girls' game was remarkable because really nobody, I think, thought the girls were going to win except the girls. And that's what I've said over and over in sports. It doesn't matter what Dusty, me, a mom, dad, a newspaper writer, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. It only matters if you believe, if your team believes, or the coaches can instill that belief in you. And if people buy in, good things can happen. That's exactly what Beloit did last night. So that was a remarkable win because they, you know, if there was a point spread on that game, Beloit would have been, I would bet you, probably a 15-point underdog, maybe more. The boys' game was remarkable because Beloit was without Wyatt Rockman, their starting point guard. One of their top subs off the bench was out. Couple of their kids had not been practicing very much because they've been sick lately. Mm-hmm. And Phillipsburg had their full allotment of players. Phillipsburg was 5-1 coming in. A lot of their wins very close, could easily gone either way, but they're 5-1. They come in and Beloit's down 13 in the second quarter. Can't buy a bucket. They're turning the ball over, and they're just there's the gym was completely dead for the boys game. There was no energy at all in the boys game. The girls game had energy, and then all the energy left when the girls game ended, apparently. And so the boys' game, it was like the players had to make their own spark to get the fans involved. And usually you like it to be the other way around. You like the fans to try to hopefully spark your team. Like when KU struggles, and I know college versus high school, but when KU's struggling at Allen Fieldhouse, you know what happens? The crowd gets into it. They understand, oh, the team needs us in this moment. Or sometimes a PA will say something, or they'll start playing the music to pump you up. But you know when you need to maybe – and our team needs a boost. Last night, Beloit, the team had to give themselves the boost. And they did. And I was talking about it during the broadcast last night that when they were down 11 at halftime, I'm like, 29-18, if they could just make a bucket and get a stop, that's it. Just one stop, one bucket, 29-20. All of a sudden, you just feel a little better about yourself because you finally scored a bucket, you've gone a while without scoring, and you're only down 9.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you know? Beloit gets a couple stops, get a couple buckets, then they get a three-pointer, and then they get a stop. Next thing you know, Beloit's only down 1 going into the fourth quarter. Outscore Phillipsburg 14-4. Phillipsburg boys only scored 16 points in the second half. And Beloit went to a 1-3-1 zone. Quinn Eilert very active at the top, forced some turnovers. That was a great move by Coach Eilert. That changed, I thought, the complexion of the game. Beloit has a 6-man rotation. They had a kid that hadn't played varsity all year long except for like 30 seconds that was their top man off the bench. I mean, Coach Eilert had to, you know, kind of space his timeouts. He had to figure out how to get his kids to rest a little bit because he had kids that weren't 100% playing. He had two kids that were out sick. And he had, you know, had a kid playing, making his first start last night that slid in. That happened to be my son. So he usually is the first or second sub off the bench. So your rotation is so short because you're missing two of your top 7 players. And you play a 5-1 team. They come in your house and they're up 13. And I would be guessing a lot of fans in the stands, just like they probably thought before the girls game started, we're not going to win tonight. They probably thought there's no way the boys are going to come back and win. We just don't have enough firepower. And to the team's credit, they battled back, made plays, got stops. And the next thing you know, they took control of the game, and then in the fourth quarter, Gershner, I know him, he had a 3 to start the fourth quarter on a great kick out by Owen Eilert. And Owen Eilert took over this game last night. He is a leader on this team. He was missing a lot of practices last week. But here's the thing. When you are shorthanded, one, you need other guys to step up. Kyler Burks off the bench stepped up. Only 2 points, but he did some really good things, and he was up to the task. I called it kind of an open audition for him to get some varsity minutes. He did a great job. You know, Caleb Burks struggled shooting the ball, but he was sick the day before. I mean, he wasn't 100%, so I'm not going to knock the kid. I mean, when you're not feeling well, the first thing to go when you're a jump shooter, your legs. You're just not quite the same. And so Owen Eilert, Beisner kind of kept him going in the first half offensively, but then Owen Eilert took over in the fourth quarter in regards to he drove the ball, he drove and kicked it for open threes for Burks and for Gershner, and then he was absolutely money at the line, 8 for 8. And you could tell he wasn't 100%. And so to me, last night, those wins for Beloit were remarkable in two different ways. The girls' game is remarkable because they lost by 41 10 months prior to this team. And the remarkable part about the boys' game is they were shorthanded. They had every reason to just pack it in and say, you know what, we're not feeling well. Nobody's feeling well. Everybody seemed to be a little under the weather. We're missing two of our key players. We're down 13. It was easy to feel sorry for yourself. And Beloit didn't. And it was not pretty. It was ugly. But it was called what Bill Self and many coaches call a grinder, a meat grinder of a game. And Beloit was able to grind that performance into a win. You're not going to win every game pretty. Not every game you're going to play great. Bill Self has said this many times before. He says there's 10 games where you play probably your A game. There's 10 games where you don't play well. And then the rest are in between. And he said the key is when you have an off night or you're not playing as well as you would like or know you're not playing as well as you can, you find a way to grind out a few of those of the 10 that aren't your best performances. If you can find a way to win half of those or something like that, you're going to have a really good season. That was one of those games last night for the Beloit boys, being shorthanded, Owen Eilert coming up big, then some timely shots from Burks and Gershner, and Quinn Eilert had a couple big plays in the third quarter as well. And Beisner, they kind of took away in the second half. They couldn't get the ball into him. Considering all of that, and to get the win after being down 13 was a remarkable win in itself, and now the Beloit boys have won as many games as they won all of last year. So Beloit girls and boys basketball pointed in the right direction, and considering how much they struggled and how inexperienced they were a year ago, it is on both sides, and I think especially for the girls, very, very impressive. And here's the thing, and why am I making a big deal about this? Because teams are going to have to deal with this. It isn't just Beloit. You're going to have a lot of teams that are going to have other kids step up, like a Kyler Burks off the bench, or you're going to have a guy take the game by the throat like Owen Eilert. You're going to have to get contributions in different ways from different people, because more than likely every team in our listening area, I would be willing to bet you, every team in our listening area is going to be short a player at some point during the month of January. Whether it's COVID, whether it's influenza, whether they're not feeling well, they have a bad cold, who knows? And that is where you find out a little bit more about the character of your team.
Absolutely. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, you gotta fight through. I mean, both boys teams I had last night had one guy out, you know, that's a varsity starter for them. Whatever the reason is, you have to have guys that are going to step up and fill in those holes when you need it, because that's the case all the time, but it's magnified right now with everything that's going around for sure.
And especially some teams that don't have the biggest numbers, you know, and like Beloit boys didn't have a deep bench to start with, basically 7 players, and then looking for an eighth or a ninth to develop into their roles. And they, you know, Kyler Burke stepped up and they found a way to win last night. And as we said, Owen Eilert had 22. He was the athlete of the game. Peyton Remus, athlete of the game for the girls. And the block of the games was from Caleb Burks that hustled down and blocked what was going to be a layup. That was a big play in the game. And the girls' game, Kylie Goddard with that huge block I referred to with 20 seconds to go. So pretty exciting stuff. Now, your games last night, you had a player that had a milestone. And listen, scoring 1,000 points, some people may think it's not that. Like, I think most people understand 1,000 points is significant, but I don't know how impressive people really understand 1,000 points in high school. Now, 2,000 is out of the stratosphere.
Crazy. Well, yeah.
But 1,000 career points in high school means that odds are you played varsity as a freshman more than likely. Mm-hmm. And if you do the math, if you just do the simple math here, you play 20 games every season and then a sub-state game. So 4 years, 84 games. In order to score 1,000 career points, you have to average about 12 points a game every game of your 4-year career. That means when you're a freshman, on average, you got to average 12 points a game. Now, what usually happens is people that get 1,000 career points, they may very well their freshman year average 7 a game. And then their sophomore year, they average 15. In their junior year, they average 19. In their senior year, they average 24. You know, you get over 1,000 points different ways, okay? Or maybe you average 10 as a freshman, 14 as a sophomore, 18 as a junior, and 23 as a senior. You work your way up. Or maybe you have 22 as a junior and 18 as a senior, but the point is you got points your freshman and sophomore years. In order to be a 1,000 career point scorer in high school, usually you need to be able to play varsity when you're a freshman, usually. Now, sometimes you might be a great player and there's just too many people in front of you, and then you become a starter as a sophomore, and in sophomore, junior, senior year, you take off and you average, you know, 22 a game the rest of your career. But when you have kids that are freshmen that are starting or playing or able to score, you already know they're going to be a thorn in the side for teams for years to come. You and I knew that immediately when we saw Trinity Luters.
Oh,
we
yeah.
knew that immediately when I saw Taryn Sides. We knew that when we saw Jenna Ferris, Vanessa Christine, we could go on. You just know. And what a milestone for her last night.
Well, I mean, you average 18 and a half as a freshman.
That helps.
You're going to get to 1,000.
Well, might get to 2,000.
As long as you're healthy and you make it through your career, you're going to get to 1,000. Yeah. And she got to 1,053 games. And that's an average of 19 points a game where she's at right now at 10-13.
She's a junior, and she's got 1,000 career
as
points.
As a junior, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, you could see it coming, and especially when you had 2 years in a row where you're averaging 18 and a half points. And
sure.
I mean, you're past 800 already as a sophomore, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so you knew it was coming, and last night she needed 15 points going in and made a bucket right there toward the beginning of the third quarter. She had 13 in the first half and got to 1,000 there early in the second half in the third quarter, and then finished with, like I said, 13 more points after that to finish with 28 to lead Osborne to a 67-39 win. So, yeah, it was clear that it was going to happen after her freshman year if she could stay healthy. And,
yep.
Again, you're talking about if you keep the pace and the average, you're going to be approaching 2,000 if you can have the success that she's had so far this year, averaging, you know, now 23.5, 24 points a game just this year. So you know, you're adding to that, and yeah, it's a great milestone for Trinity, and I know that Trina, her mom, the coach, and Tony, her dad, the assistant coach, are going to say it's a great milestone for the program too, because they're now 7-0 and 3-0 in the Northern Plains League. They made it to state last year in the quarterfinals and lost, and you know, it's something that goes along with what they do offensively, that that Trinity gets good looks, and the way they pressure defensively, she gets out in the open court and takes advantage of that and gets good looks, gets layups, and adds points to her total, and adds wins to the total for Osborne as well. So, 28 last night for Trinity. Gracie Reiner had a great game as well with 21 points, and the Osborne girls were able
to. She's a sophomore.
And Gracie's just a sophomore, yeah.
Future's bright for a few years yet.
Yeah,
they
got a couple
basketball
years at least for sure. And you know, Brooke Beffert's really come on this year. She's not scoring as much as those two that I mentioned, but she had 8 last night and has developed into a pretty good 3-point shooter. And they've got weapons. It's not just Trinity. And so you're seeing that right now with the 7-0 record after last night's win. Trinity was our athlete of the game last night. Block of the game from H&R Blockable, it went to Taylor Ellison, 67-39. It was a very similar game to the first time Osborne and Thunder Ridge girls played, where Thunder Ridge trailed by just 4 at halftime the first time. This time they trailed by 6 at the break, and then they were outscored 32-10 in the second half and ended up losing 67-39. Cameron Ritzky had 18 points. Tori Slavik with a season-high 12 there for Thunder Ridge as well last night in the girls' contest. So, yeah, congratulations to Trinity on passing that 1,000-point mark in her career. And, again, just 53 games that she's played so far as a junior. Boys' contest, very low-scoring one, much like kind of the first time these two teams met, but actually even lower scoring. The first game was 47-28. This one, 46-19. Osborne was without Ronnie Thompson, and so he's actually still out in Utah with the other side of that family and celebrating Christmas, so he didn't make it back yet. And Thunder Ridge was without Jace Randall, one of their starters, who was out with sickness as well. So, as you said, kind of changes a little bit of what you're doing with the dynamic there. Dayton Lance had a season-high 14 to lead Osborne. He was our athlete of the game from S&S Drug and Home Health. And Bullet Block of the game went to Grady Walters there from H&R Block and Boy. And Grady had 12 points for Osborne as well, as they moved to 6-0 on the boys' side and 3-0 in the NPL. Nobody was in double figures for Thunder Ridge, but Caleb Wagenblast had a season-high 8, hit a couple threes in the game as Thunder Ridge drops to 2-3 and 1-1. It was a 16th straight win for the Osborne boys over Thunder Ridge. So that's what happened on our games on Katy Country 94 last night. Some other scores from last night as we round out high school hoops from Tuesday. The girls' side, Lakeside winning over Logan Palco, 62-22. Taylor Betts with a career-high 22 points for Lakeside. Kylie Bergman, 15. Lauren Brummett, 11. Sylvan Lucas girls beat Lincoln, 41-16. Rock Hills falls to Red Cloud, 41-25. Pike Valley over Tescott, 34-15. And Smith Center over Stockton, 74-34. Clay Center beat Concordia 54-25. In boys action, Lakeside a 58-47 win, over Logan Palco. Tyler Schoen, a career-high 24, 18 of 20 from the free-throw line for Tyler. Made it to the line a lot and took advantage of his opportunities. Kylan Cunningham added 22 in that win for Lakeside as they start the second semester with a nice win over Logan Palco there on Tuesday night. Also, Sylvan Lucas over Lincoln, 64-44. Red Cloud beat Rock Hills, 57-22. Pike Valley over Tescott, 47-29. And Clay Center handing Concordia their first loss of the season, a 56-53 win for the Tigers over the Panthers. Concordia now 6-1. So let's look at what happened in our games in the area last night.
All right, locker room chats tonight.
Yeah, tonight we'll talk with the head coaches of Beloit, Osborne, Smith Center, and Thunder Ridge. Those will begin around 5:15 on KD Country 94. And you can also listen online at kdcountry94.com. Have locker room chats again coming up tomorrow night and high school hoops again Friday for the area.
One thing, too, I want to point out with those that have scored over 1,000 career points, like Taryn Sides and Trinity Luters, as two examples, you know, gals that played last night in our games on the radio and on the video stream, is you go look at their assist numbers, and their assist numbers are pretty good. Like, Sides averages 6 assists. So it's not like they're chucking every shot to get all their points. Yeah. You know, they are involving other teammates, and they are, like, it stands out to me, like, if you can score 1,000 points or you be a team's top scorer, but you're also their top assist person, then that usually means you're not a ball hog at all. It's coming within the offense. You might take over when you need to take over because you're that good offensively. But that should be noted that, you know, a lot of kids that I see score over 1,000 career points fill up the stat sheet. It's not just points. It's in other areas, including assists.
Yeah, and those best players, Emily Ryan's a perfect example of that.
Yeah,
right?
She had 16 assists the other day.
All the points and just is now an assist machine, right? 16. She was an assist machine at Central Plains.
Right.
Like she had all the stats at Central Plains. Points, yeah. Assists, rebounds, steals, yeah. Obviously.
Yeah.
I think she averaged like 10 steals a game because of the way they play defense and the way she could play defense. But, yeah, she gets to college now where she doesn't have to be that, you know, yeah, like she was in high school, that 2,500, 3,000-point scorer or whatever right. She's doing. Like you said, a lot of assists, and she's running that team as a point guard at Iowa State and doing it very well. They've got a very good team.
She had 16 the other night for Iowa State, 16 assists to Emily Ryan. All right. It's time for K-State in Focus. Our focus on Kansas State athletics, brought to you by Heineken Electric in Beloit and by Hanson Auction Realty in Beloit. Before we talk K-State, somebody asked me and said, is it weird or odd calling basketball games when your son is playing? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
It is. It's not intimidating. It's not something I get nervous about. I don't get anxious about. But it is a little awkward. Because, and I've had numerous people ask me this, and so I might as well address it right now in case people are wondering out there. Because I do sometimes hesitate, like, do I say, like, when I do a recap, like, we're just talking here, okay,
yeah,
about the game last night. And I caught myself earlier. Do I say Noah or do I say Gershner?
Yeah.
Because I know him as, you know, I mean, obviously he's Gershner. He's my son.
Yeah.
And in the entire recap, if he makes a play or does something, you know, I have to say Gershner because not everybody knows just who Noah is. There's lots of Noahs out there and this and that and so forth and so on. And so the thing, I think the biggest thing about calling your kids games on the radio is, one, I can actually, as a radio broadcaster, I want to be a professional. I've always prided myself on being a professional when I call games. And I try to be as unbiased as possible, especially when I know that I'm not calling it for just one team. And I try to give a lot of credit or point out positives for the other team as well, because I have no idea how many people are listening for the other school. There might be one person. There might be 50, 100. And so they might be listening as well. So even though I might be doing it on the radio for Beloit, that doesn't mean I can't say good things about the other team. And I talked last night about how if you're a basketball purist, you've got to love the way Terran Sides plays basketball. Now, as a Beloit fan, you're like, well, how could you say that? Why do you want Terran Sides to be so good? I'm not saying I want her to be so good. I'm saying she is so good.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that. It's amazing stuff to watch athletes like that grow as a freshman and be so dominant as a freshman. That's very, very unusual. And so when I'm calling the game, like last night, I'll give you an example. There was a play. Well, first of all, I don't want to be overly critical of anyone, especially a high school kid. And so I think for me, when I think about it is, and I've told my son this even, that if he makes a mistake, I'm not going to just ignore it because he's my son on the radio broadcast. At the same time, I'm not going to drive him into the ground because he made a mistake. And that's how I should treat every kid that plays, mm-hmm. regardless of my son or not. So if he had a play against Southeast Saline, it was just a boneheaded pass. I mean, he admits it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, dude, I just had to tell you on the broadcast, I said, I'm not sure exactly what Gershner was doing on that pass, but there was nothing there. And I told him that when we got home after the game. And he said, oh, yeah, as soon as I threw it, I was like, oh, crud. And I started running the other way because I knew, oh, what did I just do? So he had no problem with that. Last night, another example was, he didn't make a pass somewhere. He tried to force it inside and he waited a little too long, just needed to move the ball side to side. He'll learn that. He's a sophomore, so forth and so on. He's not the only one that does that. So I just pointed that out, observation. But then I point out the good things. You're like, hey, you know, spot up three, handle the ball, good mm-hmm. defense, good hustle, whatever. And that's true of any kid that I call on the game. My biggest thing is I don't want people to listen and think that I'm giving my kid this huge preferential treatment because he's my son. I also don't want people to listen and go, I'm way too hard on my son to make an example out of him either as a broadcaster, because that's not my job as a broadcaster. But I will say, when something happens and I'm watching and a call goes against Beloit that I know is not a very good call, I'm obviously going to probably say something, react, okay, without throwing the officials completely under the bus. But then when it's a play like last night, my son made a steal or a tie-up. It was a really good play. Solid play. That's what you want. And the official called a foul, and I'm immediately going, where's the foul? And I look at the coaches, Coach Eilert, Coach Beiser standing up. They're totally just incredulous. Like, what in the world? What are you calling here?
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether that's my son or not, I'm like, that's just not a good call, more than likely. But the parent in me wants to scream. You know,
yeah.
I'm broadcasting and the parent in me wants to scream and go, you just punished a kid for hustling. He got to the spot. He made the play. How can you call a foul on that? I mean, both kids have a right to the ball, this and that. That's what I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
But on the broadcast, like, well, that call is a little bit questionable. That was a good hustle by Gershner, you know. And that's the awkwardness of calling games of your kid on the radio. In a perfect world, I don't know. In a perfect world, I think I would. People have asked me, would you rather not call the games if your son's playing so you could focus as just being a proud parent and watching and cheering them on? There's times where I feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's times where I'm really glad I'm calling the games, because then I don't get sucked into all worried about just my kid as a parent. Because there are a lot of parents, when they watch the game, they're focused on their kid and their kid only a lot. And they don't understand the team concept. Whereas a broadcaster, I understand the team concept. So there's the parent in me and there's the broadcaster in me. And I call it split personalities in a good way, I think. Because when we do broadcasts, when we're by ourselves, you and I, and we've done many. Sometimes we had Clover with us for football. Sometimes we don't. But we do basketball solo. Could we have a color commentator? Sure, we could if people wanted to do it and was good at it. But we don't really have people volunteering to be on the radio. So we handle it by ourselves. And basketball is not a big deal. You don't have to have a color commentator. Football is helpful. But in football, you and I have talked about this, and are people listening, maybe a peek behind the curtain. In football, for me, I've done color commentary before, and I've done play-by-play. I've done a lot more play-by-play than color commentary, and it helps that you've played the game. You know, a color commentator that's never played the game, I don't think can be possibly a good color commentator at all, ever. You had to have at least played the game and understand it at some level.
Mm.
And so when I call a football game or I call a basketball game without a color commentator, or even a baseball game, or whatever it might be, volleyball as well, I am, in my head, I'm playing split personalities. And I've told people this before that are close to me. And they're like, they tell me, how do you do it? I'm like, you just shift into each mode. Because I've done both in my career over the years of doing color commentator and play-by-play, I can shift in my head Now, I can't throw my voice to make it sound like a completely different person. Yeah. That would be impressive. You know, if I threw the great Brian Kelly Southern accent in there for color commentary. Like, if I could just go, that was a nice play by Owen Islett taking, or here's Owen Islett. He takes it to the hoop and he scores the bucket and the foul. Yep, that was a great play. You know, what Owen did here is he diagnosed the play. Yes, I agree with you. And I'm talking to myself. I'm not going that far. But it is a bit of a split personality from the standpoint that when you're by yourself and you got play-by-play duties, but you also kind of have to take over color analyst duties as well. There's so many times where I call the play and then I stop, pause for a second, and then I diagnose the play like a color commentator. I do it all the time. I did it in football. I do it in basketball. And you know where I learned that from? Was the first person I learned radio from in sports was Rod Zook at KBBE, KNGL, and McPherson as an intern. And the one thing he told me when I did my first ever radio broadcast with him, and he was a play-by-play guy and I was a color guy, and he said, it's nearly not as complicated as people make it out to be. Mm-hmm. He said, this is what happens, okay? To make it simple, he told me, I'm the play-by-play guy. I tell everyone what happened. You're the color guy. You tell people why it happened.
Mm-hmm.
You explain it. Don't say the same thing I just said, just like I don't say the same thing that you say. My job is to describe the action, what happened. You're supposed to explain why it happened. Okay, I call the three-pointer. You explain he came off a screen, he was wide open. You know, that type of thing. And so I've always remembered it. So now I've already got that split personality experience, per se. So now I've almost got three personalities. Yes, Wade is crazy because I've got play-by-play, color commentator like last night, and now I got the third personality, and that is parent that is in my bloodstream but really trying to keep it out of a broadcast. Mm-hmm. So there's the challenge for John and others that have asked me.
I've not done the parent thing, obviously, but I've done the family thing a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
And I've done the best friend thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. When I first moved here, I was 19. I turned 20, and my buddy Jesse Carr, who's over in Beloit now, and I'd met him like right when I got here. So that was a weird dynamic for me. Is like we were literally best friends. Like, and I'm calling his beams on the radio, and I'm young. I mean, he's 2-3 years younger than me. You know, we're not that far away in age because I was so young when I started. It's just like somebody's like, you're best friends with a high schooler? Yeah, because I went to college for 2 years, and I was already out here. And so that was a weird dynamic for me when I was calling Lakeside games and Jesse was playing. Because he would come back later that night, and we'd talk about the game after it was over and what went wrong, what went right, whatever. But I've had the family thing a lot, you know. And, people know that I'm cousins with the Gateses, and those guys are like brothers and sisters to me. Like, they're not – I mean – Riley and Parker are like brothers to me. They're not.
Some days you don't want to claim them as your brothers or relation. Yeah, and maybe they do with you too.
And with Avery as well when she got up. And you know, Tyson's up now. And so it's people that you're so close with.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't want to call my nephew's games.
Yeah.
Dan Page is down at Newton. He's like, hey, if you ever want to call a Newton game on the video stream, if you're down here, you can do it. And I'm like, I better just keep the headset off.
Well, that's a cool offer.
I said, thank you for offering it. But, I have very, very limited opportunities to see Dylan play. And I'm like, I definitely don't want to have the mic on when I'm there for those games. I said, I'm taking the night off. I'm there to watch Dylan. But you do get into a different mindset because for me, my mindset when I'm watching Dylan play is not of a broadcaster.
And it shouldn't
be.
And
not even close. Like, like you said, you're kind of focused on that one kid that you're watching. And I'm focused on Dylan, but I'm focused. I want his team to do well as well. I know all those kids. I learned their names. I want to know them too because I want them to have success. But it is just a different dynamic because I'll get up and say some things I'm definitely not going to be saying on the radio.
Right.
And so you get more frustrated. And I always tell people, if I'm at one of those games and I get real frustrated, I stand up and yell something, whatever. I was like, this is why they put a headset on me during games. So I don't do this.
That's right. That's right.
But like I said, I've never had that, obviously, that father-son dynamic. But there's different things that it just feels weird, right?
It does.
And there's times where even with them, I would have been like, hey, I'd kind of like to watch this game instead of having to call it. But, you know, you do what you can and you adjust and you understand what you need to do there.
When you cover
a
team,
professional, like you said.
Right. And when you cover a team on a regular basis, you know the strengths and weaknesses of the team, okay? But when your kid plays, I know his strengths and weaknesses better than anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone. Even the coaches. I know his strengths and weaknesses better than the coaches, and I'm not talking about pure basketball play here, okay? They may know a little bit more of a strength that I don't know with basketball because I'm not at every practice. Mm-hmm. I don't go to any practices. Or they might know more of a weakness that I think he does okay in. I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about is I know his strengths and weaknesses between his ears.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I don't know that with any other player on the team. How could I?
Yeah.
And that's a different dynamic as well. Mm-hmm. So when the game is going on, I'm thinking here, okay, in my head, I'm watching the game going, all right, Noah, hustle down and spot up, man. You know, but I'm not saying it out loud, but I'm thinking it. Or he might be wide open. I'm thinking, hey, you know, drive it and kick it, and he's going to knock this down. Or I'm thinking, dude, don't do that. Don't do that dribble move. What are you doing? You know, these things go through my head. I don't say them publicly and out there until right now. And so that's the different dynamic of it. And I've done that with other players. I'm like, okay, I know this guy's really a good shooter. What's he trying to do? Drive it to the hoop when he doesn't, he's going to get rejected, that type of thing. You know these things. But with your kid, you know the mental aspect even more because you're obviously, you know, spend a lot of time with them. Because they're in your house and you're providing them with free rent and free food and everything else. So it is a different dynamic, and it is interesting your dynamic because it's not your son or daughter, but you still have a different dynamic in regards to friendships or good friendships, as you said, a great example, and then also cousins that are like your brothers or sisters. So it is interesting, and that was a really good question that people have asked me, and I appreciate John mentioning that too. All right, so K-State in Focus brought to you by Hanson Auction Realty. And also by Heineken Electric. We're not going to spend a ton of time on the bowl game last night, and I'm just going to be upfront with you why. It's nothing against K-State at all. I didn't get to watch the game. I was busy calling games, high school basketball. Then I'm working on posting highlights after the game, and you and I update the website here and there and this and that and whatever. And so by the time I get all this stuff done, I got to watch like 30 seconds of the KU men's game last night just through my phone and listened about 30 seconds on the radio when I got out of the gym last night. I didn't see any of the K-State men's basketball game, so I didn't get to see any of the stuff. I'm just going to be honest with you. If you hear me acting like I watched the game last night, I'm really good at lying to you I'm just lying to you. So I don't want to lie to you. I'm being honest. So in regards to the football game, I'm going to tell you what I know. And that is, going into the game, LSU was shorthanded. They had like 40 scholarship players. The numbers, depending on the report, change. Yeah. But the bottom line is they had a walk-on at quarterback. LSU, first of all, I give them a lot of credit.
They actually played a receiver at quarterback. The walk-on didn't even play.
Oh, he didn't? See? You can tell I watched the game. Yeah. But
I don't know much more than you do. But.
And by the way, I wasn't going to go home and watch it at midnight.
Exactly.
Because I had to be here on the air at 7. I wanted some sleep. So... And if I tried to go back and watch all three of these things, I would have been up till right now yet.
Yeah.
So I did not know that. But the bottom line is, I'll give LSU credit. A lot of teams, I think, would have not played this game. And I'll go back, and if you believe that things come full circle, if you believe that, K-State last year had no business playing a couple of football games they played. Mm-hmm. They had no business playing them. They shouldn't have. Because they were down multiple guys in the secondary, this and that.
There's no penalty for not playing them.
No, there's no penalty. There's no forfeit.
It's not on your record.
Just a no contest or a postponement or cancellation. And, you know, honestly, when they went to Oklahoma last year and won, they really probably should have said we shouldn't play because we don't have enough guys in the secondary. Somehow they found a way to win. And so there was a game or two where we had Brian Smoller on. He said there's without a doubt K-State, unlike some schools, would have said we can't play. And K-State played. And, the Texas game, they didn't have everybody, and they got embarrassed. And then K-State fans are freaking out about how bad this team is and what, it's Klieman lost them. It's like, yeah, he's lost half his team because they're in COVID or whatever else going on. So when you look at it from that perspective – now you come full circle here to a bowl game, and I didn't think this bowl game was going to happen. I thought LSU would have – to me, LSU had more excuses than other schools, even UCLA, to back out of the game. They had more reason to. First of all, SEC, the new motto, as you know, I've put it out there, their actual motto is it just means more, and I say it just means more unless it's an irrelevant bowl game, and then we don't count it because we didn't care. LSU, I don't think, really cared that much about winning that game or not. The players did that were competing, don't get me wrong, and the interim coach, which because Brian Kelly's the new head coach, Ed Orgeron wasn't there. But there was every reason for LSU to say, you know what, let's just call it ahead of time. We can hide. Yeah, you'd be more excuses now. You hide behind COVID, and you could claim you're without defensive linemen like UCLA did, and you bail. And I thought that was going to happen. So K-State played LSU. LSU was undermanned. K-State was a heavy favorite, should have been, based on who they had playing, a six-year quarterback, Deuce Vaughn and others. And K-State, to their credit, went out and dominated. Led 42-7 going to fourth quarter, scored the first 21 points. Deuce Vaughn had four touchdowns. Skylar Thompson threw for 259, three touchdowns. And K-State absolutely rolled, controlled things, had 442 yards of offense, enrolled to the Texas Bowl victory. They did what they're supposed to do. But I do think, and I know you can get caught up in that, well, it's SEC, how can you give them credit? I'm giving not the SEC credit. I'm giving LSU credit for playing the game. Because they easily could have bailed on it, and then K-State would have had no bowl game, no moment for those seniors last night to go out on a winning note, and no chance of winning an eighth game and giving Chris Klieman his first bowl victory. So LSU provided the opportunity by actually playing in it. In normal years, you'd say, well, that's blasphemous. Of course they're going to give K-State opportunity. Duh, they're going to play. Well, that's not the case this year. We've seen a few teams that had to quit, or not quit, but opt. Here we go again. Quit, opt out, whatever you want to say, because they didn't have enough linemen or this or that. And it happened to NC State, where they thought they're going to play 5 hours before the game. They'd spent all this time prepping. They had spent Christmas away from their family. And then the rug was pulled out, and UCLA, oh, we can't play. So I give LSU a lot of credit. So I'm not going to break down this game. I don't think there's really need to break down this game. I will say this. I saw a lot of comments on social media after the game last night giving Colin Klein a ton of credit for the way he called the game, his play calling, so forth and so on, because, of course, they fired Courtney Messingham. First of all, this is what happens. It's called a honeymoon period. This happens to every head coach. It happens to every coordinator, especially if they start off great, right? Like Chris Klieman, right off the bat, when he starts out great for K-State, well, we love this guy. Then all of a sudden, when they struggle last year during COVID, now, and then they struggle and lose three games to the three best teams in the Big 12 earlier this year, people say they should be fired. Okay, that's how quickly it goes from rags to riches or riches to rags. That's just the way it is. So I see all these people, oh, I'm super excited about Colin Klein. Man, he did a great job calling plays, and he had a great game plan, really impressed, and I really feel good if he's our offensive coordinator going forward, so forth and so on. I'm going to point out two things. I don't want to play Debbie Downer. One, you're playing against LSU team that had a lot of opt-outs and a lot of key players on defense that weren't playing. Okay. Two, you're going up against a wide receiver that was playing quarterback, so that helps your helps your offense, because the defense, you're going to be playing from ahead, is my point. You're not going to be behind 14-0. That changes play calling. It also helps to have a six-year senior quarterback under, you know, obviously Messingham had that too, don't get me wrong. And I'm not trying to poo-poo what Colin Klein accomplished as a coordinator. He did a nice job, called a good game from everything that I've read. But it's just one game, and it's also against a team that's undermanned. But we need a little bit longer resume or a body of work before we can say Colin Klein's a great offensive coordinator and he's great at play calling. But there are people all of a sudden making him out to be the greatest play caller that ever lived. I'm like, dear Lord, it's the first game. Here's the other thing. People study things, right? We talk about it. There's no film on the backup quarterback, and he comes in and plays for a game or two, and they can win a game or two at any level. But all of a sudden, that backup quarterback, when he's got to play week three, week four, whatever, after the starter's out, all of a sudden teams start to figure him out. Why? Because there's film. There's film now to point out, oh, that he doesn't like a blitz, or he doesn't move to his right very well, and people start to figure you out. That's just the way it is. It's called film analysis and study. Teams do the same thing in studying the tendencies of coordinators. They study the tendencies of the defensive coordinator. Does he like the blitz on third down and four? Does he like to sit back on third and 27? Does he bring the house and leave Ward one-on-one? Those type of things. There is no body of work, no tape to study of Colin Klein as offensive coordinator. Now there's one game. So Colin Klein could go out next year, be the offensive coordinator of K-State, and do an unbelievable job the first 3 weeks. And K-State's unstoppable. They're scoring 40 points a game. You're like, man, they're throwing it. They're running it. Adrian Martinez, Deuce Vaughn, this is unbelievable. And Klein's doing a wonderful job. And then week six, everybody figures it out. And all of a sudden, K-State's struggling to score, or they hit a slump, or the quarterback throws picks, and why is Klein calling this, and why isn't Vaughn getting these big runs, and why isn't Vaughn more involved? Trust me, it'll happen if Colin Klein ends up being the full-time offense coordinator. No matter who the guy is, it doesn't matter whether you're a superstar, you used to play at the school or not. Eventually, the honeymoon period wears off. So while Colin Klein did a nice job last night, no doubt about it from what I understand, let's not sit here and anoint him as the greatest offensive coordinator ever lived. He could be. Don't get me wrong. He could be an unbelievable offensive coordinator. I'm not saying he can't be. That's not my point at all. My point is we jump on the wagon all at once. We like the new flavor of the month. But once the new flavor of the month wears off, then it's just vanilla or chocolate.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I'm the guy that felt like once Mess got fired –
that Colin Klein should be the offensive
coordinator. I agree with you.
Before Kleiman even said he's going to be the offensive coordinator.
Agree with you.
And so I feel, I mean, obviously if I felt that way before, I have a stronger conviction now that I feel he should be the guy.
Sure.
That should get that full-time position.
He did nothing to hurt his case.
And absolutely he didn't. And then so in my mind, you're talking about he's got a six-year quarterback. He's got this. He's got Deuce Vaughn. And I'm like, well, next year he's got a fifth-year quarterback and Deuce Vaughn. And I'm sitting here thinking, I said that before Adrian even committed to K-State, Adrian Martinez. I was like, CK could do some things with this guy.
I totally agree.
And that's why I was excited about the possibility of him coming to K-State. And now I'm even more excited, right?
Yeah.
After you see what happens last
night.
I'm a realist. I understand that there's, like you said, a honeymoon period. There's a period where you feel real good about what you've got all the time. And then other coaches adjust. Then you have to counter-adjust. And if you can do those things, that's what makes you a great coordinator. And that's what makes fans stick around and keep singing your praises. If you can counter-adjust to the adjustments that they've done to you, it's a never-ending game, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you've got to figure it out. And that's what makes you a great coordinator or a great coach or whatever you're doing is being able to figure out being a step ahead when somebody else is doing something to try to put you a step behind.
Yeah, I always love
like
strategy.
Colin, and I feel like he's the right guy.
I agree with you.
Changed last night, but again, like you said, it is just one game, so yes. Let's kind of temper the emotions a little bit.
That's what I'm trying to say. I've always said, never be too high, never be too low. And so if you're high as a kite because Colin Klein just carved up an LSU team that was undermanned, I would say, well, let's wait to see what happens when he plays against K-State, plays against Iowa State, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, Texas next year, you know?
Yeah.
What does he do against a really good non-conference opponent? What's the offense going to look like? And it's going to be different because Adrian Martinez is more athletic than Skylar Thompson. He is faster than Skylar Thompson. Skylar Thompson probably makes more better decisions throwing the football than Adrian Martinez. And so Klein's going to have a lot to work with. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Here's Chris Kleiman on finishing the season with a win.
I'm proud of him. And they took ownership in the season, and they took ownership in finishing the story. We had one more chapter to write, and they weren't going to be denied. And number seven, Skylar Thompson's pretty special, and he came up big time today. I absolutely love the young man, and he means everything to me. This senior class has been phenomenal. They helped us adjust some things from last year, and we went out on top like we wanted to. So happy for those guys.
K-State finishes the season 8-5, and there's a reason to be optimistic about next year with weapons on offense, as we were talking about, and weapons on defense as well, especially the pass rush. Here's Skylar Thompson on finishing up his career.
You know, this is why I came back here. This is why all of our sixth-year seniors came back, was to finish our legacy the way we want to, you know. And I've been so incredibly blessed with all the people in my life, my family, coaches, teammates. I would not be standing here today without everybody that supports me and loves me and who is in my circle. So give my hats off to them. I love this team. I love this university. I'm a Wildcat through and through. I'll be a Wildcat the rest of my life.
Yeah, Skylar Thompson, you got to respect him. I mean, a guy had been through injuries, a leader on the team, and played well last night. K-State rolls over LSU by a final of 42-20. Now, when it comes to basketball last night, we talk about LSU playing shorthanded in football. In basketball last night, K-State was shorthanded, but yet fought one of the nation's top-ranked teams down to the end, but they lost number 14, Texas, 70-57. Texas took control with an 18-2 run to start the second half. It was the Big 12 home opener for K-State. Bruce Weber and seven players not at the game due to COVID-19 health and safety protocols. The pesky Wildcats are now 8-5 overall, 0-2 in the Big 12. Had just eight players, seven on scholarship, so that means one was a walk-on. And they looked like they could maybe pull off the upset. They scored the game's first 7 points. They led 35-29 at halftime. They shot 50% from the floor in the first half. But then the second half, they came back down to earth. Shot 22% from the floor. 0-9 from 3. Got to within 6 on a few occasions, but ended up losing by 13. And Texas now 2-0 in the Big 12, 12-2 overall. Sophomore Nigel Pack with his fourth career 20-point game with a game-high 21 points, 15 in the first half. As K-State 0-2 in Big 12 play. And Shane Southwell ended up being the head coach last night with Bruce Weber out due to the COVID-19 protocols, says even though his team fought hard, there's no moral victories in losing.
Obviously, we fought. We were shorthanded, but we fought hard. But we don't accept no moral victories. We told our guys in that locker room we don't accept moral victories. The next step is to get better. We obviously is a growing. But we're going to be stay connected, and we got a strong team. We got a strong team that got a good morale right now in our locker room.
All right, so K-State lose last night to Texas shorthanded 70-57. K-State women somehow are not ranked in the top 25. Their two losses are to teams that were in the top five when they played them, including number one South Carolina. They beat number 23 Oregon. They beat number 10 Baylor. And yet somehow K-State women are not in the top 25 in the polls. I don't understand it. Anyway, K-State women 11-2 overall, 1-0 in the Big 12. They'll be at Oklahoma State tonight at 6:30. And that's a look at our focus on K-State athletics today, brought to you by Heineken Electric in Beloit and by Hanson Auction Realty in Beloit. We shift gears to the KU Jayhawks, a sixth-ranked Jayhawk men basketball team, 12-1 now overall, 1-0 in the Big 12. Big second half to beat Oklahoma State last night in Stillwater, 74-63. Victory extended KU's winning streak of conference opening wins to 31, dating back to the 91-92 season. And how about David McCormick? He was benched. He was in the doghouse a little bit. Bill Self started Mitch Lightfoot. McCormick apparently responded pretty well. 17 points on 8-13 shooting, a career-high 15 rebounds in just 23 minutes. It helped rescue KU from a first-half collapse when they were up 29-15. And then they're outscored 14-0 to close out the first half. How about this? You don't win a lot of games, especially on the road, when you miss 19 consecutive shots and go scoreless for 9 minutes. That's what KU did in the first half against Oklahoma State to close out the first half. But in the second half, KU shot 71% after shooting 28% in the first half. Jalen Wilson, 15 rebounds. Ochai Agbaji, 16 points. Christian Brown, 15. Remy Martin, some clutch shots. And we mentioned McCormick, 17 points, 15 rebounds. KU defense got it done, holding Oklahoma State to 36% from the floor. And KU gets the win. Here's Bill Self on the play of his bigs, including McCormick.
Well, I don't know exactly what his role will be, but David was great tonight. You know, Mitch gave us some good minutes, too. You know, if you combine that and the big guys get 23 and 19, yeah, David was really good. And I thought Mitch got us off to a good start. And I think you could look at it. You know, we didn't play well to start the second half, but we did play poorly. First 16 minutes of the second half, you know, pretty good. Outscored them by 13 or whatever in that stretch. Happy to get a W, but certainly a lot of things we can tighten up.
KU on the road at Texas Tech, 2:30 pregame on Saturday on Z96.3 with tip-off scheduled for 3 o'clock. The Baylor Bears, number one team in the land, still perfect, undefeated. They beat Oklahoma last night, 84-74. Shifting to the NFL for a quick moment, there is a nightmare scenario developing for the National Football League when it comes to Sunday night football. This is really crazy stuff. And all that has to happen to create this possibility is one thing. If you don't know the situation, in the AFC, the Indianapolis Colts, all they need to do is beat the hapless 2-14 Jacksonville Jaguars, and the Colts are in the playoffs. Which would then mean on Sunday night when the Raiders host the Chargers in Las Vegas, the winner of the Charger-Raider game would be in, the loser would be done. However, if the Jaguars would upset the Colts, and before you think that's impossible, the Jaguars beat the Bills earlier this year. Jacksonville since 33 games, the Jaguars are 2-27 against everyone not named the Colts. In their last four meetings against the Colts, the Jaguars are 2-2. So before you just say, well, there's no way that the Colts are losing the Jaguars, it's possible. So if the Jaguars beat the Colts, listen to this crazy scenario. That would mean if the Colts lost to the Jaguars, that would mean that the Raiders and Chargers could take a knee on every play Sunday night football and just go ahead and agree to play to a tie, and both teams are in the playoffs. The Raiders and Chargers could go ahead and rest their players and say, let's just go ahead and call this a tie, and they both would be in and the Colts would be out. All that has to happen for that scenario to unfold, ladies and gentlemen, is the Colts losing the Jaguars. The NFL really will probably, if they ever want to rig a game, they might want to rig that the Colts win. Because if the Colts win, then that creates drama on Sunday Night Football and good ratings, Raiders versus Chargers, and the winner take all to get to the playoffs. If the Colts lose, all of a sudden you've got the Chargers and Raiders that if they end in a tie, they both make the playoffs. Now, if they actually play the game out, it's simple. The winner, how is that? The winner would be in, and the loser would be out. So it would behoove, if both teams want to make the playoffs, to just go ahead and end in a tie, or they can play each other straight up, and the winner would be in and the loser would be out. And I believe the Steelers would sneak in then, because if the Steelers won this weekend with the Colts loss as well. So crazy scenario. We could get the Sunday Night Football, Raiders, Chargers, and they both are in if the game ends in a tie. Would they agree to do that? Apparently it's allowed. That is crazy. All right, yesterday we talked about players opting out for bowl games. And as I prefaced at the very beginning of the conversation yesterday, while I don't like college football players opting out of bowl games, I understand. And we went through the reasons why to understand, okay? And we went through all of that. I'm not going to rehash it. So we talk a lot on this show about, well, okay, if you have problems or people complain about issues, how about trying to find a solution? Listen, I think we can agree on this. People that are okay with players opting out and people that are really against players opting out of a bowl game, we all can agree on this part. We would all prefer them to play all the games they can play and not opt out at all. I think we all can agree on that. We may understand why they opt out. We may hate that they opt out and fight it with a passion. But we can all agree that we would love the best players to play every single game they can in college and not skip a bowl game or skip a regular season game because they're worried about their draft stock, okay? I have a partial solution. And this is where I disagree with Kirk Herbstreit again. Because Kirk Herbstreit said something, and I think he's out of touch. And he said it the other day. Well, if they expand the playoff, I don't think it's going to change anything. Totally, respectfully disagree. Think about this for a second. While I talked about it yesterday, I think it's blown out of proportion, players that are opting out, skipping a bowl game, in regards to people like, oh, the teammates must hate them, they lose friendships and so forth. I think that's overblown. I think the teammates of players opting out understand and wish they were in the same position to have that choice. I think they understand that the guy really fought hard to get to where he is. He's very athletic. He's got a gift, but he's also worked hard. And who am I to be mad at him if he takes out an insurance policy? And that's, somebody pointed this out yesterday after the show. You know, really what the players that are opting out of a bowl game, what they're doing is they're providing their own insurance policy. Like, I was talking with somebody yesterday and they said, well, come on, what are the odds? What are the odds you can get hurt in a bowl game? You know, has it happened before? Yes, it has, to a couple of players. Does that mean you're not going to go outside because you're worried about getting struck by lightning? But a player, did you get Marvin? Okay. But if a player skips a bowl game because they are worried about getting hurt, quite honestly, as a person pointed out to me yesterday, and it makes total sense, that player is simply taking out an insurance policy. The insurance policy is, I don't get hurt if I don't play in the game. Let me, and then to put this into everyday life, if you're a farmer out there and you don't like players opting out, okay, they are minimizing their risk by not playing in a bowl game that has no impact on a championship or the playoff. So they opt out or they quit, whatever you want to call it, but they are minimizing their risk, even though there might be, and Max and I talked about this yesterday, you know, there might be a 1% chance that you're going to have a career-ending injury or a really bad injury and cost you millions of dollars if you play in a meaningless bowl game. There might be a 1% chance, right? Maybe it's 2.8%. It hasn't happened very often. Jalen Smith, the example from 16 with Notre Dame, cost him millions of dollars from a top 10 pick to a 34th overall pick because he shredded his knee in a meaningless bowl game. So what the players are doing when they opt out, they're minimizing their risk. You can, in essence, say they're taking out their own insurance policy. If you're, I'm just using this as an example. If you're a farmer, you have your choice on whether or not you take out crop insurance, correct? You don't have to. You can have hail insurance. You have options. You can get flood insurance. You can get renter's insurance. I don't have to even use farmers as an example. Mm-hmm. We have, now there's certain stuff. You have to have insurance on your car. I believe that's a law. Okay. But in regards to homeowner's insurance, I believe you have to have as well, if I remember correctly. But you don't have to have renter's insurance. You don't have to insure your crops. So when you think about insurance, why do people buy insurance policies, Dusty?
To protect yourself.
To minimize risk, yeah. Or protect yourself. Absolutely. So I use farming as an example. If there are a farmer or farmers screaming at players for opting out, they're minimizing their risk by not playing, even if it's only a 1% chance. If you are insuring your crops and hail insurance and everything else, there might only be a 1 or a 7% chance that your crops can be wiped out by a hailstorm. But what are you doing? You're protecting yourself or hedging your bet to protect yourself in case there is a horrible storm to where you don't end up losing everything with your crop. You're hedging your bet. You're minimizing your risk. You are protecting your investment. You're protecting yourself. That, I think, is a great example of somebody told me yesterday after the show, that's what these players that are opting out. They are simply minimizing their risk, whether or not there's tons of guys that get hurt in bowl games or not. There is a risk, obviously, playing a violent sport and getting hurt. There is a risk, as with any game. So you minimize your risk. You protect yourself as much as you can by opting out of that bowl game. Very similar to a farmer taking out insurance policy. He doesn't have to take out the insurance policy. Odds are he can roll the dice and there's no storms and he has a banner crop. There's no drought. There's no hail. There's no flood or whatever. They could roll the dice. And you know what? Most years, farmers are going to be okay. They can save money. I've had a farmer I talked to who said, if I never took insurance all these years, I would have come out ahead. He goes, I would have had years I would have been wiped out. True. But all in all, at the end of the day, had I not had insurance the entire time as a farmer, I would have come out ahead and saved myself money. Now, there's others that have been in farming maybe 10 years and been wiped out, that they've had insurance and saved their bacon multiple times. So they're glad they took out insurance policy. But you're minimizing your risk. The odds of getting your crop completely wiped out due to storms is probably not as high as people may think. But there is what? There's a chance. Whether it's a 1%, 5%, 10% chance, there's a chance that could happen to your farm. There's a chance that you could be in a rental place and you have a kitchen fire and you lose everything, or somebody comes in, steals all your stuff, whatever the case may be. The odds of that happening are slim to none, but there is a chance. And that's what insurance is based off of, man. Think about it. Insurance is completely based off of what? Worry. Fear that you're going to lose everything. You hedge your bet. You insure yourself. And it's probably very, very smart for the most part. So it comes down to, as a farmer, do you roll the dice hoping that there isn't some big storm or some big drought that wipes out my crop and I get nothing? Or do you protect yourself and minimize your risk? The same thing with the players opting out of a bowl game. It's the same thing. They're simply taking out their own insurance policy by not playing in that bowl game. So that's one way to look at it. Now I go one step further. Players can take out an actual insurance policy. If they can afford it, they can take out an insurance policy to protect themselves if they would have a big-time injury. Odds are it's not going to get them all the money they would have had they been a first-round draft pick, but it would at least salvage something, much like when you take out some kind of crop insurance, hail insurance, whatever on your farm. Okay, you're not going to... You were going to have an 80-bushel crop, 80 bushels to the acre, and you had a horrible hail and you got 15 bushels an acre, not completely wiped out, but you're guaranteed 40 bushels an acre. Okay, well, you didn't get the 80, but you got your 40, so you at least came out better off by having your insurance. So players have that option. I don't know how it works as with regards to the clauses. Like, how do you know for sure you're going to be a first-round draft pick? How do you for sure know that... You know, what if your injury isn't career ending? Does that mean that the insurance policy is null and void and you waste your money on insurance policy, plus you risked playing in a bowl game and you got hurt and then it's a double whammy? I don't know that part of the equation. But let me get me to the final and eventual point here. In regards to, and Max and I talked about yesterday, I talked to a couple other people about this yesterday. They said, listen, the problem starts with coaches. It starts with coaches leaving whenever they can leave, and then players sign this contract called a letter of intent, and then players can't leave, but they choose the coach instead of the school. Everybody knows that. Players usually choose the school, the coach instead of the school. Caleb Williams chose Oklahoma not because of the school. He chose it because of Lincoln Riley. Now Riley's gone. Now he's entered the transfer portal. And there's all this uproar with people about players skipping an exhibition or a postseason game that has no impact on a championship. There are people all mad about at those kids. Why aren't they mad at the 3,000 NCAA football players who have entered the transfer portal the last 2 months? And there are no contracts or closed periods. It's like college football free agency. And many of these kids that have transferred didn't play in the bowl game. They skipped the bowl game. Shoot, they skipped out on their team. K-State and KU have guys that quit on the team in the middle of the year. Where is the anguish and hate towards the transfer portal? But why do we have a transfer portal? Because coaches didn't live up to their commitments over the years. Well, we want to protect this kid because why shouldn't he be able to go from school A to school B if the coach is allowed to go from school A to school B? It's a fair point. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have the transfer portal. I think it's good for the kids. You know, if they're in a bad situation where they were promised the moon and the stars and they go in and they're like, whoa, that coach lied to me, I think he should have a right to transfer and go somewhere else. Now, there are times, though, where kids go to a school and they think their stuff don't stink, and they go practice, and they find out they're third on the depth chart, or they got beat out for the quarterback position. So instead of fighting for the job, what they do is they quit. They transfer or opt out of the team, and they enter the transfer portal. So where is this anger that people have directed? And Kirk Herbstreit, I would love for him to expand upon it. Where is this anger that people have for players that opt out of one game? One game. They played all season long, and they opt out of one game that has no impact for a championship. There's all that anger towards them. And I understand why people are frustrated and want these kids to play. But why aren't you screaming bloody murder all year long about the transfer portal? Where have you been? Why aren't you screaming bloody murder because Lincoln Riley and Brian Kelly quit on their teams and took a ton of money? Like, And I had a conversation with a couple of people yesterday, and they are consistent in their argument. They said, listen, whether it's coaches, players, transfer portal, opting out of bowl games, they say, listen, put it all together. To me, it's quitting. To me, it's quitting on your team. You're quitting on your team. And you signed up to play football. You should finish it, and that includes the bowl game. I respect that opinion, and I can't disagree with it. I'm okay with that, too. I understand both sides. So, What could we do to solve this problem? What could we do that would prevent players from opting out? Kirk Herbstreit said the other day, because there's a lot of talks about college football playoff expanding to 12 teams at some point down the line instead of four. He said, I even think with the expanded playoff, it won't matter. There'll still be kids that are going to be opting out. I disagree. To a point. I think there still might be a few kids that opt out. But let me ask you a question. How many kids have opted out of the national championship game on Monday night between Alabama and Georgia? The answer is zero. And there are lots of guys that are going to play pro ball and be first round picks. Why are they not minimizing their risk? Why aren't they skipping the national championship game? What about the national semifinals? As far as I know, no player on any one of those four teams, Alabama, Georgia, Michigan, Cincinnati, opted out. Why is that? See, I think it's pretty obvious. Max and I talked about this yesterday a little bit. I respect Max's opinion. He respects mine. We may disagree on things, and that's what's great about America. We can actually talk it out. And he says, teammates, if I was a teammate, I'd be ticked off and mad if somebody quit on me and didn't play in a bowl game. I'd be mad, so forth and so on. He even talked about, you know, not being a friend or friendships being, you know, strained and so forth and so on. And I think that's overblown when it comes to kids skipping, you know, the Duke Mayo Bowl, the Cheez-Its Bowl, the Weed Eater Bowl. But I will agree with Max on this part of the equation that he presented, and that is when you start a football season, you have goals. People say, well, why won't players opt out in the middle of the season if they know they're going to be a first-round pick? Well, when you start the season, your goals typically are what? Typically, it's to win as many games as possible, but the bigger goals are to usually win your league or your conference and win a championship, either win a conference championship or win the whole kit and caboodle. All right? I think teammates cut you some slack if you skip a bowl game that has no impact on winning a title. You already, your league season's over. You've played your regular season. You've played 12 games. There's an extra game, and you decide to minimize your risk. You're not going to play in the Cheez-Its Bowl. I think a lot of players' teammates will be like, okay, I don't love it, but I understand it. I get it, and I'm still going to be his friend. But extend this for a point further. What do you think teammates would think of a person if an Alabama or Georgia or Michigan or Cincinnati player opted out when the regular season ends and these four teams are going to the playoffs? What do you think they would have thought of a player that quit on them when they are one or two wins away and one of four remaining teams to win a national championship and put a ring on their finger and be remembered forever as national champions? Don't you think the feeling is different? Don't you think teammates, I'll tell you, I know it's different. You know how I know it's different? Brian Kelly did exactly that. No player is opted out, but Brian Kelly opted out from Notre Dame and went to LSU when Notre Dame, all they needed was Cincinnati to lose their conference title game, and Notre Dame would have been in the college football playoff. He quit when they still had a chance to perhaps win a national championship in a playoff. He didn't even let it play out to see if Notre Dame got in. He quit before that. And I know we've seen videos and players have talked about it. They were not pleased with their coach bailing on them. So imagine teammates when a player on their team like Alabama, Georgia, Michigan, Cincinnati opts out of the playoff. What do you think those teammates are going to do then? That will cost friendships. They will be ticked off. Because we've worked so hard all year long. Our goal at Alabama, Georgia, Michigan, Cincinnati was to get to the playoff and win it all. We are now here. We've done all the hard work to get here, and now you're going to opt out? You're going to opt out of winning a national championship? That's a lot different than opting out of a 6-6 versus 6-6 matchup in the Cheez-Its Bowl, don't you think? So here's my point. How do we solve players from opting out? If players are not opting out of the current college football playoff with four teams, and they're not opting out of the national championship game on Monday night, wouldn't it just make common sense and be logical to understand that if you expand the playoff to 12 or even 16, but expand the playoff to 12, that's what's on the table for the most part right now. You expand the playoff to 12, and people argue, well, you know, there's too many blowouts. We don't really need more games. We don't need all these playoffs. Well, you do if you want your best players to keep playing. That's my argument. Because think about it. Do you really believe that a quarterback like Kenny Pickett, if Pittsburgh was in the playoff, if there was a 12-team playoff, and Pittsburgh would have been in a 12-team playoff, by the way, do you think Kenny Pickett would have quit on his team when they're two wins away from a national championship? And by the way, the players get these nice fat rings for the rest of their life that they can display or put on their hand and wave after winning a national title. You get rings for winning conference titles too, by the way. See, I disagree with Kirk Herbstreit quite a bit. The one point I'll agree with him is there's probably maybe a few kids that might opt out still. And that will probably show the true character of the kid, because you just bailed on us when we're so close to a championship. But do you really think we're going to have just as many opt-outs? If you expand the team instead of four universities, we now get 12 different universities into the college football playoff, which means you've got more games, which means you've got more games where the best players are playing and they're not opting out. Because I'm going to tell you, this is what I believe to be true. I think the reason that players don't opt out of the playoff or the national championship game in college football, but they do for the, you know, bowl games that don't have an impact on a title, the reason that the players don't opt out isn't because they don't think about it. I bet there's some star player for Alabama thinking, should I be playing in the college football championship game? Because if I get hurt, yeah, we could have a ring, but we might lose the game and not get a ring. And then I could cost myself a lot of money by not being a first-round pick if I get hurt. You know what I think stops them from opting out? Fear. Like, there's fear for the players opting out of a meaningless bowl game of getting hurt and cost themselves millions of dollars. But there's a fear if you're a player from opting out if you're in the college football playoff or the national championship game because you know your teammates will be ticked as heck. Because that could cost us a chance at a ring. Joe Blow sitting out the Cheez-Its Bowl doesn't cost me a ring. Joe Blow not playing in the national title game on Monday night could cost me a ring. So if you expand the playoff, you will have guys like Kenny Pickett and others that will not opt out, don't want to let their teammates down, because the ultimate goal of any sport is to what? Win a championship. So I disagree with Kirk Herbstreit. I believe that if we expand the playoff, which it sounds like it'll eventually happen, your opt-outs will lessen, at least within the 12 schools that make the playoff. Now, granted, you're still going to have those bowl games for, you know, K-State's ranked 23rd and they play Navy that's 25th in a Liberty Bowl. Yeah, you may have opt-outs. That's true. That's very true. But when you expand a playoff to 12, you're going to have more games. And honestly, that's more wear and tear on the bodies for these guys because they're going to play even more than the games they are now. But I'm telling you, they know they can skip out of a bowl game that doesn't have any impact on a championship. And yeah, there might be some teammates that aren't like thrilled by it, but they know it'll be understood. Because you can argue, listen, guys, we're not winning the title. That was our ultimate goal. We're eliminated. We're playing in a Cheez-Its Bowl. And the players will cut you some slack and be like, okay, we'd like you to be here, but we understand because, you know, it is a bowl game. We want to win. The seniors want to win, like K-State did last night. At the same time, we get it. You know, you can move on. But you better not move on when I am one win away from a national championship. You better not move on when I'm right there in the college football playoff. And so thus, I think a partial solution to the problem of players opting out. And when you think about it, a lot of the players that are opting out of these games are part of really, like LSU's a prominent school. Players for Oklahoma have opted out. You've had players that opted out for Florida. I mean, we're talking about prominent schools. Okay, if they're in the top 12, I don't think they're opting out because there's too much pressure even from boosters and alums and everything else going, dude, this is you're LSU, you're Oklahoma, you're Florida. All right, you're even Pittsburgh with Kenny Pickett. Dude, this is our one chance to win a title. We're in the playoff. We Pittsburgh hasn't won the conference since 1983. We won the conference title. We're in the playoff. Dude, I almost guarantee you there are players that still think about opting out but going, there is no way I can do this to my team because we're this close to a title. We are one of 12 teams that has a chance to win it all. And that's no different than the current playoff. We have four teams. There were no opt-outs of those four schools that I'm aware of.
No.
And I think it eventually somebody might do it. And that will burn bridges. No doubt. And if people listening going, well, wait a minute, what's the difference? A bowl game, you're quitting on your team. And now you're saying that you're not going to quit on your team because of the playoff? Yeah, because the playoff is much more important. Winning a ring is much more important than playing in the Liberty or Texas Bowl. Now, for K-State, it's very important last night because that's the best they can do.
That's where they are.
That's where they are. But if there's a player, you know, if Deuce Vaughn opted out and knows he's going to be a first-round pick, K-State fans might not like it. There will be K-State teammates that might not like it, but I guarantee they understand it a lot more. But if Deuce Vaughn and Kansas State makes it to the college football playoff and there's 12 teams in K-State, even if they're the 12 seed playing the 5, don't you think there's a lot more of an uproar from the fan base and from the players and especially the coaches if you opt out of a playoff? So thus, a partial solution to keeping the best players and the best programs with their best players for the postseason is to expand the playoff. I totally disagree with Herbstreit on that.
Yeah, I didn't know. The only thing I saw from Herbstreit was the one where he was talking about the kids just don't care anymore and it's just a different dinner.
He said if we expand the playoff, I don't see it changing much, is what he said.
That's,
and here, I'll give you an example why I think I'll give you another example why I think he's wrong. How many basketball players have opted out of the NCAA tournament?
I don't think any.
I can't think of one. I know a Duke kid opted out early in the season last year because of COVID.
Yeah.
Because he was going to be a first round pick. That was an extenuating circumstance. I maybe somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. I have never heard of a college basketball player going playing all season long, and you and then you're part of the 68 team field. You're part of the big dance, and you opt out before the tournament. Now I'm open to being proven wrong, but I can't think of one player that's opted out. Now why wouldn't they, Dusty? Because you're playing extra games. You're going to be a first round draft pick. Why wouldn't you opt out? Like, you see all these kids college, they don't play in the NIT. I've noticed that. Well, of course they don't. Nobody cares about the NIT for the most part. But everybody cares about the big dance. And why do you care so much about the big dance? Because you're one of 68 teams still alive to win a championship. So if you quit before the NCAA tournament, you are letting down your team, and especially if you're a great player, which odds are you are if you're opting out and you think you're going to be in the draft, you are preventing and hurting your team and your teammates and coaches' chances majorly of winning a trophy, a national championship trophy like Baylor held last year. So in college basketball, we have 68 schools, and we can't think of a player opting out right before the NCAA tournament because he's worried about his draft status. So if we have all those players and they're willing to play up to six games in the span of 4 weeks, why do we not think that football players wouldn't do the same thing if we expand our playoff from a four mini tournament to a 12 or 16 team tournament? To me, the proof is in the pudding already in basketball. And I know they're two different sports, but you don't see kids opting out of the NCAA tournament. But you see them opting out of the NIT.
Yeah.
That's the comparison. Yeah. NIT is the impervious bowls that we have now, and the NCAA is the college football playoff. Because the NCAA tournament is a playoff.
No, it's it's by definition what it is.
It's like a 68-team playoff. And so wouldn't that help if we expanded the playoff? In football,
yeah,
many ways.
Yeah, it helps in a lot of ways. But yeah, in this aspect, I 100% feel like it would help. I mean, yeah, Pitt's in that game. Say they're the whatever seed they are, the six or whatever,
right?
And they have that first playoff game. They're Kenny Pickett's playing. Like,
right.
I'm pretty confident about that.
And by the way,
if they lose the game, they're done anyway, right? So you're
coming have a month
out,
off.
You're going to come off of maybe a week, maybe two, out of your conference championship. You're not sitting around waiting 3 weeks for a bowl game either. So I think that helps from that aspect too. If you're going to have a playoff, you're probably going to start it the week after.
I would imagine,
championship games for your conference.
Sure.
So you can get it done at a decent time, right? You don't want this thing to.
You don't want to compete with NFL playoffs.
NFL playoffs, yeah, right. Exactly. So that would help on that aspect of it too. And I think that's a big thing with the NCAA tournament is we're playing right away after our conference tournament. Mm-hmm. There's no break in between this and the NCAA tournament. We're playing again either Thursday or Friday, some cases Tuesday if you're in one of those play-in games. You know, you're playing right away after your conference tournament's over. You're not waiting around 2.5-3 weeks to get a bowl game to start your tournament, whatever you're doing.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of positives, I feel like, with the playoff. But that's definitely one of them. I'm not quitting or opting out or whatever you call it if my team's in the playoff. I mean,
because one of the arguments a player can make when they opt out of a bowl game that doesn't mean much, they can say, listen, it might mean something to you, but listen, we can't win the title. That's a good excuse to say, well, it's time for me to move on. I played for 12 games with you. I love you as a teammate, but listen, I'm watching out for myself here. I'm going to take out my insurance policy by simply not playing, minimizing my risk. I know there's not a great chance I'm going to get hurt, but I just don't want to take that chance. You know, people talk about chances, and it's amazing. You don't want to get breast cancer, right? The odds aren't. I mean, you don't have. The odds are better you won't get breast cancer. We have our middle son has Down syndrome. Do you know what the odds of him having Down syndrome? 1 in 800 births.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may say, well, you know, I'm not worried about having more children because that's only 1 in 800 chance of that. Well, after we had our second child, we worried about having a third child because we're also sitting there going, well, you know what we're sitting there going? Well, what are the odds we'd have another child with Down syndrome? Very unlikely, but it was very unlikely we would have a first child with Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So people can say, well, the odds are great, or, well, not very many players have ever got hurt in a bowl game that you're talking about. Well, all it takes is one, and we know of one, Jalen Smith. So it's same, and it's funny because in society we're like, we play those odds and talk about, oh, well, I've got great odds. I'm not worried about it. But yet at the same time, we got worse odds and we spend money buying lottery tickets. That always cracks me up when I think about it.
Yeah.
So you badly want to beat the odds to win money, but you want to have the odds work in your favor in other things, and it doesn't always work that way. And so as long as there's a chance you can get hurt, you may skip out of a bowl game. There is a chance for you to get hurt in a college football playoff and a national championship game, but my point is, you know, you're going to catch a gigantic backlash from your coaches, your university. You're going to catch it from your teammates, and you're going to catch it from your fan base, because especially if you're a really good player, and odds are you are if you're opting out, and you're going to cost your team a chance at winning a championship. You know, can you imagine the Stetson Bennett? Well, he's been a walk-on. I think his scholarship now. But can you imagine the best? Georgia's got all kinds of first-round draft picks on their defense. Can you imagine Georgia's best defensive player after the semifinal or before the semifinal just said, "I'm opting out"? Georgia hasn't won a national title in 40-some years. Do you think that would go over well? So I think players think about it, but they're fearful in a different way. The players that opt out are fearful of getting hurt in a meaningless bowl game. And then the players that aren't opting out of the playoff in the national title game are not opting out because of fear of the backlash. So thus, you expand the playoff. I think you, in a way, you guilt or keep the kids to honor their commitment, because there's still at least that big goal to reach, and that's a championship. The Cheez-Its Bowl is not a championship.
Yeah, I don't – listen, I'm not playing for the Texas Bowl trophy, you know. Like, you guys can have that if you win it.
Right.
But I don't need it, right? It's not the trophy I came here for. It's not the – I don't want – that's not the ring I want.
Right.
You know, just kind of that aspect of it, if you're using what just happened last night, especially because you're sitting around waiting and waiting and waiting, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's just – a championship is a championship no matter what, and you want to play for that. That's the goal.
Sure.
You want to play for the national championship.
Yeah.
You want to play for the Lombardi Trophy, the Larry O'Brien.
And you're willing to risk injury for that, yeah, than risk winning a Cheez-It Bowl.
Yeah, I want that, you know, that crystal ball that they used to have at the, I don't know what the, yeah, trophy is right now for the college football playoff, but, well, it's that gold, you know, I want that gold football on a pedestal there. That's what I want.
Sure.
You can make your bowl trophy as big as possible. That's not what I came here for.
Right.
And that's most people's goal. And,
yep,
and if that's not what you get, then hey, my next goal is that I want to be in the NFL, and that's the prime goal. That's the top goal.
Right.
And I want to stay healthy, and this is how I feel like I should do it.
So there you have it. There's different perspectives on the whole players opting out. We covered that yesterday, and then, of course, some today, too. And like I said, the person that told me this yesterday, I was talking to him, I thought it was a very good point. He said, listen, it is a player opting out of a bowl game that has no impact on a championship, because he listened to our show. And he said, you know, when you think about it, the player is taking out his own insurance policy. And I was like, oh, my God, that just set the bells off in my head. I'm like, that makes so much sense. Because what you're doing is you're minimizing your risk. You're protecting yourself. And yes, the odds of you getting hurt are very slim, but as long as there's a chance you can get hurt, you're going to protect yourself. And don't we do that in everyday society? That's why we have a thing called insurance. We have it on homes. We have it on cars. We have it for renter's insurance. We have it for farmers. We have crop insurance, hail insurance, flood insurance, earthquake insurance, hurricane insurance. We do all that. What are the odds you have flood insurance? What are the odds you're going to have a flood that wipes out your house? Pretty unlikely. But there might be that chance. So why do you get the insurance? Because of fear and worry. So you hedge your bet. That's no different than what the player is doing opting out of the bowl game.
Yeah.
That's no different. Now, he can actually get an insurance policy and try to cover and get some of his money back if he has a career-ending injury, like we talked about earlier. So I thought that was a very interesting twist to looking at it. So take it for what it's worth.
Yeah.
But at least here today, and if Max is listening out there and others, too, that I've talked to since yesterday's show, is that we have a bit of a partial solution. And I'll end with this, and I'll say it only because Dusty didn't hear me the first time. If you're anguishing and you're really, really mad at players opting out of a bowl game because you feel like you're letting down a team, you're not honoring a commitment, and you have the right to that opinion. I'm not going to disagree with it. I just told you yesterday why we understand what they do. But then you should be mad as hell about 3,000 players in the transfer portal right now.
Mm-hmm.
3,000 players who have quit on their teams or universities, and some quit in the middle of the season, and yet we're screaming at the kids that skip one bowl game that means really not a lot. In the big picture, championship does. Kids aren't opting out of that. And we're not screaming, yelling about coaches opting out and one that actually left before he could have been in a playoff. No players are opting out of the playoff, but Brian Kelly, if Notre Dame made the playoff, he would have opted out as a coach.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to be upset with the players skipping one game, then you need to be all over this and say, this is a joke that a kid from K-State or KU or Nebraska played four games, and then he ended up going to second string at quarterback or running back, and now he's going to transfer. That kid quit. He quit in the middle of the season. He didn't even let it play out. He didn't fight through adversity or anything. He didn't even earn anything. Whereas the kids that are skipping the bowl game pretty much have earned, one, their starters, their stars. They've earned something to have the choice to step out of a bowl game, one game. But where's all the anguish and hate towards all the kids that have jumped the gun after not even trying to make it work at some of these schools? Maybe some people listening say, well, I lump it all together, so I'm consistent. But I don't hear a lot of people screaming about the transfer portal. People talk about it. I know coaches don't like it, but I don't. Players love it because they can just jump and go. It's like college football free agency. But if you're really, really going crazy because some kid didn't play in a bowl game, well, let's spread the craziness around, I guess, towards the 3,000 kids that are opting out, opting in, quitting. You can call it whatever you want. But coaches have done it, and the reason that there's a transfer portal is because coaches are the ones that get chosen when players go to schools, and instead of being locked in a letter of intent, when your coach leaves, hey, like Caleb Williams, Lincoln Riley leaves, okay, well, at least I have an option here to transfer out because I chose Lincoln Riley, not Oklahoma, and that's why I went to the Sooners. He at least has an option now. Before, you didn't. So I think the transfer portal is great for the student-athlete. And it makes sense because if coaches can jump up and down all the time and leave, why can't players? But there is a ripple effect, and that is players quitting in the middle of a season because they don't give it a chance. They don't want to work through. They want to automatically be handed a job. All right, I'll give you an example. Charlie Brewer was quarterback at Baylor. He went to Utah, was basically promised a job, lost a job after week one, immediately transferred and quit on his team.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the types of players you should be yelling at. In my opinion.
Yeah.
Not the guy skipping the Mayo Bowl.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.